Hi, I'm Ted Zoller, and you're tuned into On the Heels of Innovation, a podcast powered by the Entrepreneurs Genome Project at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. How is it that some people are successful in pushing their ideas further and faster than the rest of the world? What characteristics do they share? Which skills did they work to hone? And what lessons have they uncovered through each step forward and back that can inspire you to accelerate your own ideas for a business or venture? This podcast will explore the perspectives, insights, and journeys of innovators and entrepreneurs who combine creative thinking and perseverance to go beyond the expected. On the Heels of Innovation is powered by the Entrepreneurs Genome Project, which is a research initiative that I lead with my students in the Entrepreneurs Lab class at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, revealing the DNA that makes up successful entrepreneurs. Well, welcome to On the Heels of Innovation, and we're here today with Diana Kander, who's a great friend, and I'm so excited that you're here at Carolina. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you so much, Ted.
I'm so excited about all the work that you've done. You're now a best-selling author, you're a noted speaker all over the world, you're a thought leader in many areas of innovation and entrepreneurship, but I would love for you to unpack for us kind of the journey you've been on and to tell us your story in your words.
I came to the U.S. in 1989 as a refugee from the Soviet Union with my parents. My parents were 30 years old. I was 8 when we came over. They had $267 to their name. My mom kept it in her bra on their way over. And when they got to the U.S., they got jobs at Pizza Hut and TJ Maxx, making minimum wage, which is like $5.15 an hour. And they quickly realized they had very limited upward mobility. So they had no capital, they had no connections, they didn't have an education, and they barely spoke English. So my parents knew that their only way up was through entrepreneurship. So they started a business, which was a manufacturing operation making crowns for people's teeth, like a dental laboratory. And that was when I was in middle school. They started it, and it was very bootstrapped. You know, they only bought enough supplies that they could afford for crowns that they had pre-sold. So it started off very small. And then by the time I was in law school, my parents had grown the business significantly. Now they employ 17, 18 people. And they went from being barely able to provide for themselves to now providing for all these families with really great paying jobs. And you know, there's something so magical about that transformation and watching it as I was growing up. I fell in love with entrepreneurship and what it could do for you. And then as I became an entrepreneur myself and I started a number of different businesses, the first three I owned equity in were started by somebody else. I was the minority partner, so I learned on other people's dime.
Some of the best things you can learn from being part of someone else's startup.
Of course. It was a very valuable experience. Then I launched my first company where I was the majority owner, and that was in 2008, which was like right before the big recession, but it turned out great for us. It created a huge opportunity for the company that we started, and that company was very, very successful. And then I had several other businesses that both worked and didn't work. So just to give you an idea of all the different industries that I had businesses in, I owned bars and restaurants, I had a construction management company, a real estate investment company, legal staffing and consulting, several software products, including tax prep for truck drivers, legal consumer software, legal software in a B2B space, several products. Now I have books and a podcast. So in a number of different industries. And I've met a lot of entrepreneurs. I've worked with a lot of entrepreneurs. And the magic that it's had on my life and my parents' life is not always the same for everybody. So I've also seen the other side of it, which is people lose their life savings. People lose important relationships in their lives. People take their lives because of entrepreneurship. There is very little in between. It's either incredible or it's very difficult. And so I became really committed to helping prevent the dire things that could happen in entrepreneurship. And that's when I decided to write my first book, which kind of summarized the experience that I had launching companies. That's a really long explanation.
Well, actually, that's really helpful because that brings us up to date. That's when we started our relationship. We got to know each other when we were both at the Kauffman Foundation.
Yep.
And you were just starting to write your book, All in Startup, which now has turned out to be one of the all-time hits in entrepreneurship for all the right reasons. And I remember in the day you were worried that it would even get, critical acclaim.
Right.
You were kind of worried that it would kind of not work, and it worked immensely. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, Ted, I wrote a dirty business book. And it's kind of got its own genre. So I wasn't sure if it was going to be marketable. It was a bet, but I wanted to write a book that students would read in school. And it was really important to me that it was entertaining and fun.
That it was.
And that was the goal that I started with. The reason I started writing it at the very beginning was because I had just launched a business that was one of those high growth startups. We raised almost $500,000 in startup funding, and it started out really, really well. We found a problem that was very important and worth solving, but our solution didn't solve the problem. And we spent all of our runway on version one of the product and didn't save ourselves enough room to iterate and make other versions. And at the point that I realized this, which was too late in the business, it was a really difficult time for me personally. I had trouble going to work, looking anybody in the eyes at the office. Like I just knew what was coming. And I started writing as a way of therapy for myself, just writing what had happened and the lessons that I had learned in the hopes that maybe one day somebody else could avoid going through those difficult hardships.
Was that cathartic for you personally?
Yeah, it was very therapeutic. In fact, whenever I'm having a difficult time in my life, I start writing as a therapeutic way. So I started my professional career as an attorney, and that's when I first started writing my first book, which nothing turned into it. It didn't turn into anything, but it was a fictional story about a young associate at a big law firm, and hilarity ensued.
Ironically, John Grisham lives on Franklin Street. We can swing by and you can talk.
Mine was less John Grisham and more like the Devil Wears Prada, but at a law firm.
Well, I'd like to read that book. I think you should dig it back out and republish it. I think it sounds really good. Diana, I want to go back just for a moment because, kind of a window that you opened was observing your parents go through the experience of transforming from people who are, coming to this country with nothing and then, serving other families and end up, building something that would take care of other people, but then seeing other people that were left outside of that opportunity. And that suggests to me you have a call to action a bit, that you're actually using your work as a way to draw out some of the challenges in our own society and also trying to bring about what your vision of society would look like. Is that right?
I believe entrepreneurship is transformational. I actually feel like we make too much of a big deal about entrepreneurship and all the intricacies of it. I think that entrepreneurs are people who set crazy goals and reach them. And that's it,
That's it.
So I would compare an entrepreneur to somebody who's an Olympic athlete. Same, like we just come up with crazy ideas and then we figure out how to get to them. And yeah, I think there should be more of that. Not enough people set goals in their life, let alone try to reach them.
Is the issue that people don't set the goals for themselves, or are there inherent barriers to them being able to see those goals being attainable?
I would say the vast majority of people don't set goals for one reason or another. That sounds really crazy, but I have this whole workshop on curiosity and this unique approach to asking the right questions to get to whatever goal that you set for yourself. And I've been doing it in like workshops with a lot of women's leadership groups. And the hardest part is getting them to state a goal.
There you go. So I've been talking about this notion of gumption.
Uh-huh.
And you and I had a wonderful conversation where we were starting to understand this term gumption and that initiation, that people giving themselves permission to do something. And you were quick to point out that men and women see gumption differently.
Yeah, there's all kinds of research that shows that gumption is much more difficult for women than it is for men, that when women fail at something, when they go for it, they are much less likely to ever try again. So asking for a raise, asking for a promotion, applying to a job, they're just less likely to ever try something like that again. And they're also much more likely to discount themselves. So there's this other study where men and women were asked to take a test, but before they did, they were asked to rate how well they thought they would perform. And women always underrated themselves based on how they did, and men frequently overrated how they would do, but they scored the same on the tests. So I think that you can easily see that in real life. In most job descriptions, women frequently feel that they are not qualified enough to go for certain things, whereas men are more likely to think, well, I'll figure it out.
Do you think that there's a function of the fact that they're socially embedded in different ways, that women are embedded with a closer network and men are, you know, perhaps a little bit more cavalier about their networks?
Yeah, we talked about this as well. It's a more complicated answer, but for women, relationships are their center to how they define success for themselves. Men define success in their lives based on what they are able to achieve, and women define success by the strength and health of their relationships. And there's something about, again, this is a complicated theory, but women have relationships with other women when they have the same level of power and self-esteem. They have to have an even amount of it. And so if a woman takes an initiative and goes for something, it could disrupt the power balance in their female relationships, which are at the center of their self-identification. So they're often afraid to knock those things off balance. They might not even know it, but at a subconscious level, that's happening.
They're almost, deviating to the mean or holding themselves back.
Just keeping everything.
Just keeping it cool.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary and such an amazing insight. We're going to be digging into this insight, and I look forward to working with you on it. But it brought you to move on from All In Startup, which was a hit story that was, honestly, about a young kind of impressionable male entrepreneur being coached by a very savvy, wise female entrepreneur. And turned out to be, I think, a moral lesson for a lot of folks on how to ask the questions that would otherwise take the venture down. What was the big takeaway that you learned from engaging that work with the community?
Well, the mentor didn't start out being a sassy woman. The mentor started out, as in every other book, being a white man in his 50s, which is like how it is in every book. I just wrote, what I knew and saw everywhere else. And I had this whole process of testing the work with lots of different people and how they felt about the characters. And people were like Sam is based on a mentor of mine whose name is Sam, who gave me great life advice at the very beginning of my journey. And people were like, meh, this Sam guy, could take him or leave him. And a friend of mine said, hey, what if we made Sam into an alcoholic cougar, hot lady? And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. Why not? And people seem to really like that change.
It's an impressive twist and certainly gets people engaged in the content. And I think that's really one of the big wins was this was the first business book that I recall being written on a fictional frame. Can you think of other examples?
Well, there are lots of fables that are written.
Game theory, negotiations, things like that.
That are
but
used.
Nothing like an entrepreneurship.
I don't know anything else in entrepreneurship that's like that. And it's PG-13. It's definitely the first one of those.
it was so impressive, and it's universally loved by my students. And this brings you to your second book, which you've self-published and is turning out to be as big a hit, called The Curiosity Muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me how one book led to the other, or how your journey led from one to the other.
Sure. So All In Startup is all about the entrepreneurial process and launching disruptive products, launching things that don't exist in the marketplace, and how you figure out whether they actually create value. And that book got in the hands of a number of large companies. They said, can you come teach our people how to think more like entrepreneurs? And I said, sure. How hard could that be? Turns out
it's pretty
quite
hard.
Difficult. So I started working with a lot of really large organizations, and I quickly learned that the problem wasn't these tools and techniques that are in all in startup, but it was all this fear-based stuff that's holding them down. So I could teach them lean methodology and design thinking, but because they were so afraid at work, they would never do any of it. And I actually came up with a list of 17 different things that people feared at work. And they were afraid, you know, not just of losing their job or not getting their bonus, but they were afraid of taking responsibility for something that didn't work out. They were afraid of offending a fellow team member by disagreeing with them. They were afraid of just getting attention of any kind, good attention, bad attention. Like, it was a big shock to me. So I really started to dig in, and I learned that there are a number of companies, you know, that have peaked, that it's much harder actually to stay at the top than it is to get there. As hard as entrepreneurship feels, it's much more difficult to continue a certain level of success.
And growth.
Yeah. And I wanted to figure out why that happens. So curiosity muscle is about why companies that are operational peak, lose their curiosity and lose their relevance with their customers, and what they can do to maintain that level of curiosity so that they continue to innovate and evolve as their customers and their needs evolve.
And you know, I felt like I was almost in a boot camp reading the book in some ways, because you were challenging folks to think well past what they would think on the surface. Let's get to the pit of the question. Let's keep on prosecuting until it hurts.
Right.
That's the way it felt. tell us some how that insight came about, and what was the key lesson you're trying to help these leaders understand?
So there is no growth without pain. If you think about going to the gym and you pick up a pair of like 1 pound weights and you start doing weightlifting exercises, you're like, this is so easy. I can do this all day. And it does nothing for your strength, your flexibility, your osteoporosis. Like, it feels easy, and that's because it's doing nothing for you. So if you want to develop muscle and strength and everything that strength training can do for you, it has to hurt. Like, it has to be difficult. And that is also true for feedback from your customers. It has to hurt. It has to be surprising. Otherwise, there are all these blind spots that are negatively affecting your business and slowing it down. And most organizations are very happy and complacent, thinking that everything is great until it is not, until it's too late.
Do you think that they fail to ask these harder questions that sometimes result in responses that might be painful because they're afraid of what that response would be?
No, it's uncomfortable. It's a very human, natural tendency to be comfortable. So, of course, we're not going to ask those questions. Of course, we don't want to. They don't make a conscious decision to not ask them. They apply confirmation bias to only seek out evidence that lets them know everything's going great. And for most organizations, that usually means no news is good news. You know, we haven't heard complaints, so everybody must be over the moon happy. And that is not true.
In fact, a lot of us were programmed, and when you make a wave or if you stir it and it doesn't stink, you know, don't raise an issue.
Yeah, somebody once said to me, I'm not going to ask my customers if I could do anything better because I don't even want them thinking about that. Because they said to me, I said that once to a customer, and they were like, yeah, I am unsatisfied. And then they fired us. So I will never again ask a customer what we could do to be better or whether they're really satisfied. And I just, that's how most people think about it.
So I'm imagining you embedded as an entrepreneur and you have now an entrepreneur in residence program, which is quite exciting, where you're helping them train these muscles, these curiosity muscles.
Yes.
So that's giving you some scale into these organizations and understanding them in a more nuanced way. But it occurs to me that one of the things that's challenged as an entrepreneur in a larger organization is that the larger organization loses its ambition. And I'm curious if you see that there's a connection between curiosity and ambition. Do you think they're related?
No. I think that every large organization is very ambitious. So one of the most interesting things about big companies that go down, which is one of my hobbies, to research corporate failures, is that they don't slow down their level of innovation. Most large organizations that end up failing have sped up their innovation in a significant way. So they have a lot more projects. They're taking on bigger and bigger risks. So they're probably more ambitious before they go out of business. It's just that they aren't really listening to whether things are working. Uh-huh. They have developed this expert mindset that makes them feel like just because they had success in the past that they can now predict the future. And nobody can predict the future, not even weathermen. You know?
That's so true. You know, I'm seeing in my mind someone who becomes complacent because they've been successful, and just, you know, some people will attribute laziness, but yeah. It's really a lack of rigor, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lack of self-awareness. It's really what it is. It's a lack of humility to say that I might not. You know, a lot of large organizations think that they know their customers better than their customers know themselves, and they are so way off. Their customers are changing faster and faster. The needs of their customers are determined not by their interaction with your company, but by their interaction with every other company. And those companies are changing at a faster rate today than ever before.
You know, there's a lesson that you've imparted in your book that I want to kind of bring into focus, and that is the feedback should surprise you.
Yeah.
I'm curious, now that you're embedded in several of these leading companies who are seeking your help.
Yes.
Because they're at the point where they have to, you know, transform themselves.
Yes.
What are the surprises you're learning from that experience being inside?
That the number one thing that I've learned is that there's risk is a really important part of the conversation. And so you can't, you know, certain organizations, they take risk very seriously because they deal with human life or they deal with some other very important dynamic. So they want to be innovative. They want to make decisions faster, but they want to do it without increasing the level of risk that they're opening themselves up for. And that is possible. It's just a little tweak. I just think I walk into a place like a core entrepreneur, and I'm like, you know, let's break everything. Let's make a bunch of prototypes. You know, well, you can't do that when, like, if you're NASA, you can't just like go break stuff and just see how it works. You have to have the same curiosity, kind of rigor for getting honest feedback and trying things, but you have to do it in a way without increasing risk. So that's probably my number one surprise. And then the second biggest surprise is that being innovative and being curious is not a mindset, it is a series of habits. It's been like a really big aha for me over the last year, that it's not how you think and how you see the world, but it is what you do on a day-to-day basis. So you can see yourself as a fit person or a healthy person, but if you show me how often you go to the gym and what you eat every day, I could tell you whether you're really a fit and healthy person. And that's how I've started looking at curiosity and the ability to innovate, not what do you believe, what do the posters on your wall say, but what do you do on your projects on a day-to-day basis?
You know, it's really a function of what you do as opposed to what you think.
Yeah, I've learned in the last year, there's actually this fascinating research by somebody that kind of helped create the field of organizational learning, Chris Argyris.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. From Harvard Business School in the 1970s, who has all this research that shows that who we aspire to be is very different than who we actually are at work. And being able to hold up a mirror to our actions and say that they don't actually fit with what we're trying to do and who we see ourselves at is very powerful.
You know, with this in focus now, I can't wait for your next chapter. So I'm going to be reading the next one with great interest. And you know, you had us at Hello. I feel very privileged to have you on this campus for this short amount of time, Diana. And thanks for sharing your story.
It is my pleasure. I feel like we covered a lot of ground in the short period of time. So
well,
this
it's
is
all
awesome.
Your fault because you introduced all this amazing work, and we're just thrilled to have you. So thanks, and signing off from On the Heels of Innovation with Diana Kander.